This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You and I have unfinished business.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Get away from her, you...
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight?
You want answers!
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
At the movies on BFM 89.9.
I'm Wapagan Ampuke Pagan, and on the show today, I'm going to be talking to Louise Story. She is the executive producer and writer of a brand new documentary called The Kleptocrats. It is 86 minutes. It is directed by Sam Hopkinson and Havana Marking, and it is all about, well, our 1MDB scandal. Louise, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Louise, talk to me about the inception of this documentary. At which point did you get involved?
Oh, sure. I worked on the film from summer of 2017 until the present. But as you know, I've been involved in this story going back actually 5 years. So I was investigating dirty money flow around the world and looking at how illicit money came into New York City real estate starting in 2013.
Right.
And while doing that, I came upon a condominium that tied to Joe Lowe. And that brought me to Malaysia. And I did, you know, as you know, a big investigation connecting the 1MDB fund to the U.S. real estate and Hollywood films that Joe Lowe and others were involved in. So my involvement goes back 5 years.
And that's when we first spoke, after the publication
right.
of your investigative piece.
That's right.
And in many ways, I think your investigations kind of triggered something in the minds of Malaysians as well. After reading that piece, I think people became a little more aware of what Joe Lowe was up to. Also because you guys, for the very first time in the New York Times, translated the piece into Bahasa Malaysia, right?
What we did is we translated a summary of it. But we did that, and it's not something the New York Times does very often, but the New York Times did that so that the story would reach more people. And I think it also sent a signal, you know, that the audience to us was the world audience, but also the Malaysian audience, and that we took, you know, both constituencies seriously.
And of course, that makes perfect sense, because this 1MDB story for us has been very much a national tragedy here in Malaysia. And it is very difficult for a lot of Malaysians to be able to disconnect from the emotion of everything that went on. And I'm curious, in your process in talking to Malaysians and trying to get this story, was that something you came across? Were people incredibly emotional and invested in this scandal involving billions of dollars across dozens of countries in what might be the biggest financial heist in human history?
Yeah, you know, it really has been a journey in terms of the conversations I've had with Malaysians. I've gotten to know many pretty well over the last 5 years, and that's helped motivate me in my work, and that's why I decided to do this film. But back in 2014, when I came to Malaysia in July 2014, I was actually revealing this to some of the people I was interviewing. People there, you know, had suspicions about 1MDB, or maybe they had read about the prime minister's stepson, Riza Aziz, being involved in Hollywood, and maybe they had questions about his movies, but no one had pieced it all together. And actually, people had real sadness when I started explaining to them what I was seeing and connecting the dots. And so I was really giving the news to people at that time. And when my investigation ran, that then kicked off the law enforcement investigations at the U.S. DOJ and others. And then, as you know, a few weeks after my story, The Edge and the Sarawak Report published bombshell documents that really moved the evidence forward significantly on the
Correct.
Case and showing the 1MDB and Petrosati deal. And so because I had just been out with this big investigation, I was hearing not only from my sources on the investigation, but just regular Malaysians who were now following me on Facebook and on Twitter. They were messaging me saying, whoa, is this true? And if you recall, the Prime Minister, the former Prime Minister, challenged the veracity of the documents that The Edge and the Sarawak report published. And so I had a lot of people reaching out to me, you know, just direct messaging me on Facebook and saying, we don't know what to believe. What's going on here? And so I saw that journey. And then, of course, when the DOJ brought the asset forfeiture case in the summer of 2016, people really started to get that, okay, this is something here. This is real. And one of the more moving figures, I think, in the film is Anise Siafika.
Yes.
And, you know, she's a young activist in Malaysia, and she had been a, you know, ordinary college student who, when she saw the DOJ case, wanted to do something and rallied a lot of students and so on. And so watching people like her also really change the course of their lives because of this case was a kind of amazing to watch. And she's her story is in the film.
And I think for me, that was one of the revelatory moments in the film, because obviously we've heard so much about the 1MDB story, and we've heard about the financial impropriety. We've heard about Joe Low, but we've not heard about how it's affected the everyday Malaysian. And for me, her story was something of a political awakening.
Absolutely. It was a coming of age story that in some ways is a metaphor for the Malaysian public somewhat coming of age in the political system, where one party ruled a long time. And it really took a lot of people there opening their eyes, so to speak, to change politics. And of course, I personally have no stake in what way any election would go, but I really could see an ordinary Malaysians them questioning government more than maybe they had ever done so before. And Anise tells that in her story.
And I think post May 9th, Louise, that is the biggest change, because for a lot of us, you know, a politician is a politician, but the big change is how the public are reacting to our politicians. I think that fear is gone, and that is something that Anise displayed in the film, the lack of fear.
Absolutely. The lack of fear and the courage. You know, there's a part in the film where she talks about being followed when she was planning a rally. And she says, you know, she just hopes that she can be safe just to get to the rally. And that kind of bravery, you know, is amazing. And in fact, she did get arrested, but she kept on pushing anyway. So it's very moving. Another thing that we did in the film that I think also speaks to a change in how people around the world are viewing corruption is we try to tie it to ordinary cost. You know, a lot of times people don't understand that corruption, stolen money, really cost the public. And so there's a scene in the movie where Tony Pua, the politician who, you know, very actively raised questions about 1MDB all along, he talks about the $27 million diamond that was purchased for Rosma Mansur, the former prime minister's wife, with some of the 1MDB money. And then he takes out a calculator and he figures out how many teachers it would pay for in the course of a year. And it's something over 3,000 teachers you could pay their salaries with just that one small diamond. And so, you know, that awakening is important too. And from what I've seen in my conversations with Malaysians, because I still have quite a lot of them on WhatsApp in the last year or so, is a realization that corruption costs everyone.
So Louise, with that in mind, who is this documentary for? Who is your target audience?
Well, there really are two target audiences. And this is also how I approached my original article I did. One is it's for people around the entire world, because when a mysterious billionaire shows up and starts spending money in the nightclub scene or funding Hollywood movies or buying expensive mansions in a place like the United States, it's really important that people question that and raise flags with law enforcement, because that money may come out of the pockets of people somewhere else in the world. So I think it's very important for people around the whole world and in the U.S. and in London and different places where people who sometimes misappropriate money move to ask questions. So that is one audience, the general public around the world who might be around people moving in with mysterious money. But it is also for the Malaysian people to show them the whole story in one place. You know, this is a story that a lot of Malaysians followed incrementally all along. And I think now that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, that it's a value for people to be able to sit down, look at it in one place, even keep it, and, you know, years from now, as their children get older, show them what happened so that people don't forget.
Which leads me to my next question, because we don't quite have an end as yet. And so I was wondering, why now? Why have you decided to release this documentary now? Because obviously the end might be a couple of years from now when all of these court cases work themselves out.
You can debate when an end is on a story, of course, but it is clear that the prime minister is no longer in power. It is clear that Joe Lowe cannot travel around and spend money freely like he once used to. It is clear that, at least by these parties, no more money should be able to be taken from 1MDB. So there is already an immediate ending. You're right, there may be an epilogue, but there's not really a big question anymore whether serious authorities around the world have evidence and believe that there was stolen money here. And so I think that there's enough of an ending to tell the story. And if you wait till the cases totally play out, you might be waiting 20 years. I don't know if you saw on Friday, but Imelda Marcos,
that's right,
was just convicted in a case related to something in 1991. So, you know, I don't think we should wait for every single thread of this to play out, because I think it's an important enough story that people should know now. And there really is the ending. You know, the final scene in the film, you see the boxes full of handbags and cash being carted out of the former prime minister's home. And from a cinematic standpoint, there is an end. And also from the sense of authorities coming in and saying what they believed happened, there is an end. And of course, we'll watch the cases, and we haven't worked out the whole distribution plan yet. So until it gets distributed, it's possible we can amend the ending with a card updating things that happen. So if something happens and, you know, if Joe Lowe or some of the parties win a big ruling or something, we can certainly look at amending that. But I think that this is a good moment to show this film.
As you well know, Billion Dollar Whale is well a part of the national consciousness here in Malaysia. And Tom Wright is featured, and Bradley Hope, both of them are featured extensively in your movie. And in their version of the story, Joe Lowe is at the center of this conspiracy. In your version, you've kind of spread the blame a little more. Can you talk to me about that, as to who you believe is at the center in your version of the story?
Well, Joe Lowe has always been central in my reporting and work. I mean, the headline on the original New York Times investigation on this talked about Joe Lowe, and he was in the picture on the front page. And so, you know, there have always been central questions about him. But his tie to the prime minister and the prime minister's family has always been a very important one. As I say in the film, you know, there's a scene early on where I talk about the fact that I was told in 2013, as I started my reporting on the Time Warner Center condo complex, I was told that a young Malaysian businessman showed up to penthouse 76B, and he told people he was buying the unit on behalf of a group of investors that included the Prime Minister of Malaysia. And as I say in the film, it was at that moment I knew it was a two-headed investigation. It was an investigation of Joe Lowe, and it was also an investigation of the Prime Minister of Malaysia. And so from the start, it's a two-headed thing. And, you know, the fact is, if this had been a financial heist that was not tied to a political figure, to a head of state in some way, it would have been a good financial story, an important one, but it would not have been the story that it is. There is a different thing in a financial crime that where money is taken between financial players than there is in a financial crime where money is taken from the public. And so these allegations that this is all tied to a political family have made it even more of public interest. And so the film includes both heads of this equation, the investigation into Joe Low and the investigation into the Prime Minister of Malaysia.
Louise, there are a couple of revelations, I think, for someone like me as well, who's kind of followed this story for such a long time. The first one, of course, was your footage of Joe Low walking into the building, followed by Prime Minister Najib Razak. And I don't think we've ever seen that before.
For people who have been closely following this case, there are new things to see in the film. So those people should see it, that even if you think you know everything, there are new things in the film. So I'll walk you through what those are. So first of all, if you're curious, there are photographs that I took in December 2013 at the Wolf of Wall Street after party. Those have never come out before. And they show, you know, Joe Low in the VIP area, Riza on the couch with a model, but they also show, if people who know Joe's family know what they look like, you'll spot Joe's family in some of those photos. And even a photo of Joe's father taking a picture on the scene, which kind of shows you that, you know, they were excited to be there. So those are new. You'll also see, it's never been anywhere before, this audio recording that I was given of Joey McFarlane, you know, who was Riza Aziz's partner in Red Granite. I got a secret audio recording of him talking about the people behind him, and he called them, he said they're like the Kennedys, and it gives you a feel for kind of how he was talking about Red Granite in Hollywood in 2011. So that's in there. And then, yes, there was a stakeout that a colleague of mine and I at the Times did, and I had taken some video for that, and it shows Joe Low and the Prime Minister entering separately and then meeting up. And it was in September 2014. And at that time, Joe Low and the Prime Minister were very much trying to disassociate from each other and saying they didn't really have much to do with each other. And so, you know, it was important when I saw that they were actually meeting. So that's also new. Another thing that's new that I think is quite noteworthy, and I imagine government investigators might pay close attention to this, is there's footage from a party in Saint-Tropez where Joe Low is dancing with Paris Hilton. And there've been a lot of photos from this party that have come out that anyone, you know, would have seen. But what you've never seen before is we got footage with audio of what Joe said at that party. And this was right in the couple months before the 1MDB Petro Saudi deal closed. And so he's at this party and he grabs the microphone and he says something like 50 bottles of Cristal is not enough for the, he uses a foul word, but for the S four-letter word, you know, so 50 bottles of Cristal is not enough for what we've got coming from the Saudis and Malaysians. Bring on 100 bottles of Cristal for everyone.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting in terms of, you know, obviously in these cases, you know, there may be debate around, you know, from Joe Low's side about, you know, what the intentionality of those deals were. And this footage, when he describes them as he does, and you'll see if you watch the film, kind of the tone on it, I think, you know, will be of interest to people looking at those cases.
The other big revelation, of course, was your extensive interview with Najib Razak. And I found that to be very interesting because he's not spoken that candidly about this before. And of course, this interview took place after May 9th because he talks about his brother being arrested and how that felt. And I'm curious, I think for a lot of people, the question in their mind is, well, why come out now? And I think the revelation from Najib Razak was there was a point when he goes, I was afraid for my life. Did you believe him when he said that?
So, you know, I have very closely followed and reported on what's been going on in Malaysia since 2013. I didn't write 20 articles or anything. So it's not, you know, I really did one mega article, but then I was in very close touch with people all along that period. And so I've been aware of what, you know, has been going on internally with that family and internally with the changing tides with the political parties. And so I wasn't coming cold, you know, with the film. to Nazir Razik this summer and understanding what went on in terms of, you know, in Malaysia, people within BN became concerned about what was going on. But people also within the prime minister's own family had over a course of a few years, as Nazir talks about in that interview. So because I had followed this for so many years, you know, I had a base of knowledge. I think that he adds, and you're right, it is the first time he's spoken out on this. I mean, it's a pretty extensive comment, and it adds a bit of a human dimension. Many people can relate in their lives to having siblings doing things that they might not like, or, you know, and that's what the story Nazir tells. And I think he was a good person to frame the place of the Razik family in Malaysian politics. You know, he talks about their father and the legacy that he had. And so it felt like a very human way to bring in a little bit of history of Malaysian politics and then show an insider who became disenchanted and concerned and fearful over what was happening with 1MDB. And just like a niece is a bit of a metaphor for the eye opening that a lot of Malaysians had, in some ways, Nazir seems to be a bit of a metaphor for what insiders in the BN party who ended up leaving the party felt, you know, even if Nazir didn't publicly go that far at the time.
One last thing before I let you go, Louise. The other thing that you bring up very extensively in your film is the Hollywood connection. And it's interesting because you paint this picture of, I guess, a whole bunch of Hollywood types who are just along for the ride. Most of the time, they sound like they're playing dumb and they have no idea what's going on. But it's also this sense of entitlement, like, well, we're Hollywood. We deserve all of this fanciness. Is that enough of a get out? Because even at the end, you kind of make it clear that all of them are going to say, well, we had no idea what was going on. We just, well, we've returned the stuff that was given to us. But it feels like there's a moral ambiguity there.
The DOJ has not brought accusations against the Hollywood players that received the gifts from JLo and others, you know. And so there really is not definitive information at the moment that players in Hollywood deeply knew what was going on here. So it seems like at this point, what you can say about people in Hollywood and also what you can say about people, the real estate people on the real estate deals and the people at Christie's and Sotheby's who sold the art, what you can say right now is not enough questions were asked. There really is not evidence that the people who benefited from this in the United States had chapter and verse on what was happening. And so, you know, we'll watch that and see if more comes of it. But as you know, as a journalist, you can only put in, you know, what you really know. And that's what's out there on this now.
Louise Story, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
We will let you know as soon as you'll be able to watch The Kleptocrats. You know, stay tuned to this space. You've been listening to At The Movies. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.